I'm Andrea McPherson, reading from my second novel, Beyond the Blue, which was published in January 2007 by Random House. The novel is set in 1918 Dundee, Scotland. The reading I'll do is from the beginning. A light so shifting, so gray and wavering, they might be figments. Their figures are dark, shadowy in the early morning light. A steady stream of bodies come up Caldrum, past Murphy's restaurant on the corner and the tenements towards the Bowbridge jute mill. Some may speak to one another, but most are quiet, still reminiscing about the warmth of their beds. Morag might see them from the window of the flat if she was inclined to look in the moments before she leaves. It is early morning in the late spring of 1918. Women walk by the tenements, their shoes loud on cobblestones, their coats like the long tail of a kite, as if they are all one, indistinguishable and vague. The four women in the tenement flat on Caldrum Street are no different than the other women in the town, women left abandoned, forgotten, freed. They keep their anger and their secrets close as bone. The scent of tea and smoke fills their lungs and infiltrates their dreams, to dream of smokestacks and wake with the scent of ash in your hair. In the early morning light, Morag and Wallace walk across Caldrum Street and into the grounds of the Bowbridge Jute Works. Always there is the camel with its hump, its downward gaze, its hard eyes, the suggestion of something exotic as they slip into the dullness, the boiled-down necessity and daily cruelty of the works. Wallace says, "Another day." Morag looks at her daughter with a mix of recognition and shallow guilt. Wallace was walking under the arch into the fumes and danger of the works. Morag feels she's failed. She never wished this fate in her children. But now, here Wallace is, stoic as ever, walking in her black boots into the grounds of the Bowbridge Jute. Morag turns before she enters the warehouse and looks for Wallace, her dark coat in a sea of coats and long skirts. She sees her finally as she hesitates next to the lackluster beige stone of the building. She watches her daughter cross the threshold into the carding room, take one sure step into the building. Wallace pulls at the thick, dull jute, lets it fall into large barrels. The rollers revolve at various speeds, fleecing the jute with large metal pins before it's condensed into the fiber they call silver. Silver, as if there might be something beautiful, something breathtaking about it still. Wallace looks down the row of girls standing at their carding machines, recognizing them all. Across from her, May's eyes well up, and Wallace notices. May says, "No, not yet. I haven't heard from Peter." Wallace closes her eyes to the broken apart look of May's face. She knows the look, knows the pained feeling behind her eyes. She's about to say, "I'm so sorry, May," when there's a crack, a loud, hard sound in the air around them. The chatter of the women stops. Wallace is absolutely still and silent for a moment before she hears the cry, the long, anguished cry of someone in unbearable pain. May breathes, "Good God." Wallace does not look down the row of women in the direction of the cry. She does not see Elsie caught in the carding machine. She will not know how to explain it later, but she does not want to see her tangled body, a body that she will later be told had been bent, broken, trapped by the rollers, and the possibility of her own future. Such accidents are possible, probable, and Wallace does not want to commit the scene to memory. Wallace takes a step backward, away from the other women who are rushing forward, burdened with their unfortunate curiosity. She's paralyzed with fear at the possibility of the sight of Elsie. Elsie's eyes, her body wrenched into the machine, and the sheen of her dark, polished boots. Wallace counts the buttons on her own boots. 1, 2, 3, and gets to 6 before the men rush in, mumbling and cursing as they try to pull Elsie free.